News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you're having a great day today, whether you're listening live here on Saturday afternoon on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620, or whether you're listening to the podcast version of the show, wherever you get your podcasts, whenever you darn well please. We are hoping to make your day just a little bit better by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. Joining me to do so, as he does so very often on this show, please welcome Jeremy Branch.
Man, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here. I think we have an exciting show in the works. Since the last time that we talked, I have a couple things going on that I wanted to mention to the listeners. In addition to making sure that you have added Let's Go Pensacola to your RSS feeds on your podcast listening platform of preference, make sure you head over and check out Jeremy Branch on YouTube. A couple of weeks ago, Julia and I started discussing our top 25 films in each respective genre for the 21st century. We've got more of those on the way, but as a result, it kind of inspired me to maybe jump into talking about some of my favorite like horror subgenres within the last 25 years. So if that's something you're interested in, check that out. Got some fun stuff to discuss today. And that's about it, Julio.
Yeah, you've done a couple of those now. I will admit, Jeremy, I haven't gotten a chance to watch all of them, but I did watch your supernatural horror one. Was that the first one you did?
It is.
Yeah, which was really good. And, you know, not just because Jeremy is a guest on the show and because we love Jeremy as a person, but it is actually a really good video and you should check it out.
I appreciate it, man. Yeah, I've gone into the direction of horror thrillers and international horrors. We're going to do science fiction horror, which kind of mirrors something that you and I have coming up soon. So, yeah, we're just going to continue to kind of explore that because Julio mentioned, like, you know, we're 25 years into the 21st century. This is like a really good time for a retrospective. And I think he was 100% right. So,
which is crazy.
Y'all enjoy those.
Which is crazy because I feel like we shouldn't be 25 years into like my life, much less. this century, but you know, it's like,
no kidding.
Like there's times when I feel like I'm pushing like 80 and there's times when I feel like I'm, you know, 16. So,
and I mean, I can only speak to my experience, but to me, I feel like I grew up on movies of the 80s and the 90s, but there's like less of those in my life at this point. Like really, I'm still growing up and I've seen 25 years worth of movies in those decades. So anyways.
Yeah. I mean, I think in fairness, both of us have probably, you know, seen way more than 25 years worth of, I mean, obviously, you know, we grew up with a lot of the movies of the '80s and even, you know, digging back, you know, into, you know, stuff that was from before we were born. Speaking along those lines, like out of nowhere, I saw this week, a remake of Witchboard opened up.
Oh,
it's like,
I remember that.
Yeah. And I remember the name of the movie, but like the fact that somebody's even bothering to remake that movie and the fact that it was made and came out and I literally hadn't even heard about it.
Yeah. I didn't know that either.
It's like, you didn't put a lot of effort into that. And it's directed by Chuck Russell, who's done some, you know, legit films over the years, including some legit horror films over the years. What was the big one that he was known for that's just gone out of my head? I mean, the probably his biggest film of all time is the Rodney Dangerfield classic Back to School.
Okay.
But had done a few horror things as well. And also directed Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Blob, did The Mask and Scorpion King, so. The other hand, like a remake of Witchboard's kind of in some ways below this guy, but Dreamscape is the one I was trying to think of.
Yeah, those are a couple of good movies.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, was producer on a number of other things and, you know, has been around for some time. He actually didn't direct, I'm sorry, I was incorrect. He didn't direct Back to School, but he was producer on Back to School. Some legit film credits and also a remake of Witchboard. Well, I mean, you know, and also Scorpion King is like, you know, varying degrees of legit too. Let's be honest. I mean,
yeah,
it is a movie that was made.
Speaking of movies that were made, you went and saw Americana last night, and while I don't think it's been, like, well-marketed, I was curious what you thought about it.
Yeah, so it's, you know, interesting, like, half-life to this movie because it was made a couple of years ago and debuted at the South by Southwest Film Festival, I think it was, in 2023. And it took, like, a year after that for the film to sell. And then,
well,
like,
got a Sydney Sweeney in it, so yeah, that probably didn't hurt.
Yeah, and then another year and a half to you know, actually get released. Yeah, it's weird. It now stars possibly the two most overexposed people in movies right now, with the possible exception of Pedro Pascal not being in it.
Who's the other one?
Paul Walter Hauser, who's been in literally three films in the last 4 weeks. Literally, Fantastic Four: First Steps, Naked Gun, and now Americana within the last 4 weeks.
Crazy.
So, yeah,
the male Sidney
Sweeney. Well, I mean, I think Pedro Pascal is the male Sidney Sweeney in more ways than one. But Paul Walter Hauser is definitely showing up in a lot of stuff. He's going to be in the Springsteen movie that's coming out before the end of the year, too. So, you know, it's just one of those weird confluence of events things. But yeah, not a bad little flick. Not just the two of them, but Halsey is in it. One of our favorite character actors, Zahn McClendon, who was, of course, big on Reservation Dogs, but it's pretty much the go-to Native American adult actor right now.
So good.
Yeah, you know, he's been in, you know, been in just so much stuff. I really like that guy. I think he's just fantastic, and he's really good in this. And Eric Dane, you know, number of people that you've seen before, a number of other people that you haven't seen before, but it's this kind of like, it really reminded me of a lot of the 90s indie crime flicks that came out, like, in the aftermath of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. Like, it's got
energy, huh?
Yeah, it's got some of that Tarantino energy, but it's not really, like, it's not as, like, over-the-top violent as some of that stuff, and it doesn't, like, weigh on all the pop culture stuff the way some of that stuff does. I mean, there's a little bit of it in there, but not really. But like, it had a little bit of that energy, a little bit of Wes Anderson energy, a little bit of Allison Anders energy, like Gas Food Lodging. It's this this kind of rural crime action film set in like the North Dakota, Wyoming border area. And you know, all of these people that are, you know, chasing after this MacGuffin, which in this case is a Native American tribal garment that's called the ghost shirt.
Okay.
It's this very valuable item that the Native American characters in the film want to get stolen from their people. And there's these, you know, antiquities collectors and, you know, et cetera. And it's interesting because Sidney Sweeney is being like put out there as the lead of this movie, and it's really way more of an ensemble piece. And I would say in a lot of ways, she doesn't have as much to do as some of the other people in the movie, but she's Sidney Sweeney. She's the flavor of the moment. She's got, you may have heard, Jeremy, that she's got great jeans and hers are blue.
Hers are blue. When you said that she has more things in one thing with in common with Pedro Pascal, I didn't know if you were talking about his huge giant resume.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just in the fact that, like, they are kind of like the two, like, I mean, even more so, we make a lot of fun of Glenn, oh gosh, what's his name?
Just Powerson,
yeah, Glenn Powell being, you know, America's Next Great Movie Star and, you know, like, being in everything. Glenn Powell's not in half the movies that Pedro Pascal's in right now.
Seriously, yeah. I just now watched this movie called Freaky Tales.
Oh yeah, I've heard nothing but good things about that.
I think you'll like the flavor of it, man. It's an 80s set kind of anthology series where they all tie together. It's cool, man. You'll like it. Yeah.
Well, we got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Take a bite from the
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line. And Jeremy, in a time that everybody is focused on the Ozzy Osbourne years of Black Sabbath, Noah Hawley says, you know what? Ronnie James Dio is pretty damn great too. And yeah. and stuck that track there from 1982, I think. The Mob Rules appears at the end of the first episode of Noah Hawley's new series on FX, Alien Earth, which of course is
Neverland.
Yeah, of course, part of the Aliens, Prometheus, whatever other, like, what are the 12 other movies in that series at this point? Part of that world that Ridley Scott started and then James Cameron ran with in Aliens. And one thing I'm not real clear on in this, Jeremy, maybe you are. We're going to talk a little bit about this this new series. Where does this fall in the timeline of all of that? Do you know?
So Alien Earth is set in 2120, making it a prequel that takes place 2 years before the original Alien.
Okay.
And that would be a number of years before Aliens, which took place in 2179.
But isn't Romulus also a prequel? Am I mistaken
Romulus
about that?
Romulus takes place in 2142, so 20 years after Alien.
So it's between Alien. That one's between Alien and Aliens. So is this the earliest thing on the timeline, or I guess Prometheus and Covenant are before that?
Correct. Well, so yes, exactly.
Okay, so this comes after Prometheus and Covenant, but before the actual good Alien movies.
Yeah. Let's, and to that, this is very clearly indebted to Ridley Scott's universe, similarly to the way that Alien Romulus is, to the point that Neverland, which is obviously an allusion to Peter Pan, which has a lot of really thematic tie-ins with this series, but it is very much like a homage in the opening, almost shot for shot to Scott's 1979 film.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's the aesthetic is very much based on the aesthetic of the original film in a lot of ways, and a lot of the costuming and a lot of the tech and a lot of the digital graphics on screen, you know, in terms of like when you're looking at a computer screen or something like that. It looks like the tech we saw in the 1979. Am I right about that? Is that the correct
year?
Yeah. In the 1979 film, it definitely, you know, they're going for that. You could tell.
Imagino really might as well be the Nostromo from the original movie, which is the Nostromo.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair to say. And yeah, there's the aesthetic is there, and that's one of the things I like about it. But I also like that while the aesthetic is there, they're not afraid to realize that aesthetic through the lens of, what is it, 40 some odd years of better special effects?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, 45 years? Jeez, that's about right, isn't it? 45, almost a little more than 45. Whew. So, you know, that, you know, it, they don't just make it look like 79. They do take advantage of having, you know, some more modern graphics here and there. It like kind of feels like a way too. And maybe again, this is getting into the Ridley Scott of it all, but I feel a little Blade Runner in here too.
Absolutely. So our new addition to this canon is a category of kind of a mix between synthetics and cyborgs, where they're called hybrids, and what they're doing is they're taking fully synthetic bodies. Think David from Prometheus and Covenant, or of course Ash from the original, or Bishop from Aliens. But they're doing this Black Mirror kind of thing where they're able to transplant memories and kind of the essence of a person
consciousness
into these synthetic beings, and that's like a new thing we've never seen before. And I think that's why they call this episode Neverland, you know, because in Neverland, the children never grow up. And that is a kind of prevalent theme throughout this whole first episode.
Well, yeah, in that, and we'll go ahead and put up the spoilers here. If you have not seen the first two episodes of Alien Earth have dropped on FX, they're available on for streaming on Hulu. If you haven't watched them yet, we're going to get into details here. So just be forewarned. Here's your spoiler warning. But because of this developing technology and because adult minds can't handle the transfer, they're transferring these children with terminal illnesses as, you know, this is the only way to save their lives, basically. That's their reasoning to get their parental permission to do this. Because it's, if you think about it, it's kind of horrific.
To
think about what they're doing to these kids, but it's like either that or they're going to die. But so these are kids, you know, averaging anywhere from 10 to 12 years old that are being transferred into these fully adult bodies. And the new names that they're given in these adult bodies pair up to characters from Peter Pan.
Interesting that one of them is Smee, which is Captain Hook's kind of right-hand man, where the majority of them are actually named from The Lost Boys, which they're even referred to as The Lost Boys in this. But our lead
here, it gets the name of Wendy, which is, of course, Wendy Darling. And it's funny because, like, the mentor scientist who oversees them, the Dame, what is the character's name? Dame something.
I don't know.
But she calls her darling on a regular basis too. So,
which is Wendy's last name. Yeah, for those of you that are familiar with the work,
Wendy Darling. And yeah, when they put these kids through the transfer, they have them watching Peter Pan on the ceiling of the medical facility that they're working in too. So fun little. It's one of those things that we only get through the glory of all the corporate mergers that we've had over the last few years, and that a property that started out as a 20th Century Fox property now can use Disney stuff with impunity because it's all one big happy family.
And this is something that I don't think we'll have a lot of time to delve into, but as far as the world building goes, there's these five major corporations that are essentially in an arms race to develop what is considered immortality through these synthetic beings.
Right.
It's Prodigy that is actually creating the hybrids. And Prodigy is led by an eccentric trillionaire named Boy Cavalier.
The names in this, the names in this are like verging on George Lucas, but okay.
They really are. I don't know if that's like a future thing, but tell me that it's not a coincidence that Boy Cavalier is like almost Mark Zuckerberg to a T.
I mean, I think there's a little Elon in there too, you know.
Of course.
Yeah, it's definitely like these young self-made billionaires that we're seeing tonight. There is some serious commentary going on here. You know, and it's funny that I mentioned the elements of this are only possible because of, you know, the corporate the corporate overlords that have developed over the past, 50 years or so. But this world is what happens when corporate overlords take over everything. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this is only 95 years in the future.
Not at all. And it's kind of funny. There was this little, Easter egg thing that I saw being discussed on a Screen Crush, I believe. And they were referring to this beer that's featured in the first movie called Aspen Beer. And because the movie itself was a critique of corporate culture, they didn't want to like use product placement in the movie. Fast forward to the Disney acquisition of Fox, and they actually made Aspen Beer to sell as a tie-in to Romulus. So I always think it's fascinating to see this very anti-corporate media being sold to consumers as almost like a form of rebellion that's really safe for the corporations themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, Disney has indulged in this a little bit over the years. I think that one of the things I enjoyed about Tim Burton's version of Dumbo, which is a little bit little bit of it's not the best flick in the world, but what I thought was interesting was that the entire third act is basically an indictment of Disney.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And yet Disney released this movie and put out merchandise based on this movie. And it's like this, we live in these weird times, basically, is what it boils down to.
Yeah. And so overall thoughts on the series. What do you think, man? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I really, it took me a little bit to get into the first episode because it felt like a lot of stuff was being thrown at us and we were being thrown in the deep end. But I think that's a good thing. I felt like it wasn't, here, we're going to hold your hand and we're going to spell out in very, glaringly bad dialogue or news reports or whatever, exactly what's happening in this world. No, they trust the audience to figure it out. And I don't think it takes that long to figure it out. So I like that about it. Big fan of the cast, in particular, Sydney Chandler. Who is our lead here as Wendy, who is, I've been a fan of her for a couple of years now. I don't know if you saw Pistol, which was a mini series that was also on FX, if I'm not mistaken. It was based on Steve Jones's memoir, and it's about the early days of the Sex Pistols.
Oh yeah, you mentioned that.
Directed by Danny Boyle, who is just one of my favorites. And she really ran away with that show. She played Chrissy Hynde, rock icon, lead singer of the Pretenders. You may or may not know that, Chrissy Hynde was started the Pretenders as kind of an American expatriate in London. And she worked in Malcolm McLaren's shop. And she basically was there at the birth of punk rock in the UK and was part of that scene and was kind of a driving person in that scene. Sydney Chandler just stole that show as Chrissy Hynde. Like, I would have rather actually watched the Chrissy Hynde story with her starring than that show, as good as that show was. Very different character in this, and we'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line, and we are talking about Alien Earth, the new series on FX. Noah Hawley's made some interesting music choices throughout this series, but one of the things that I think is interesting is that he seems to end every episode on like a hard rock metal track. And we mentioned in the last segment, the first episode ends with The Mob Rules by Black Sabbath in the Ronnie James Dio era. And then the second episode ends with that song right there, Stink Fist from Tool.
One of my absolute favorite songs.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the overall theme is there. It's not necessarily something that's echoed throughout every episode because there's a lot of other music used, but there is a lot of, like, weirdly, because it's something that I don't think we've seen in the Alien franchise as a whole. There's a lot of like modern music used, but like a lot of like there's some jazz standards in there. There's some like old show tunes. There's like modern stuff like TV on the Radio showing up in there. It's really interesting, but like all the music does seem to fit, which is weird. And like I said, in a franchise that really hasn't been known for using any kind of, for lack of a better term, pop music at all.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But we were talking before the break about Sydney Chandler, who is the lead in this show. And, you know, I was giving some praise for her role in Pistol, which you should definitely check out, in which she played Chrissy Hynde. Her character in this, though, she is playing a 12-year-old girl in an adult body that is newly in an adult body. And I'll be damned if she's not wholly believable.
Yeah, her in particular, all of the Lost Boys are really good at that. Adults that have the mannerisms of, you know, prepubescent children, like you said, 10 to 12 years old. So, like, that's the kind of cool thing to be able to see performers do. And she's great at that.
Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be some interesting commentary with that along the way, too. I'm a little bit concerned about where they're going to go with that. But it's also, I mean, that's kind of the point, too. This is the point. And I want to say overall, too, because we've already talked a little bit about some of the commentary that is being made about corporate culture and the way corporations are taking over the world. The sci-fi is at its best when it's using outlandish trappings to comment on current day society.
So are they about Disney adults, like millennials?
I mean, that's one way you could go with it. Yeah, it could be, but
that's kind of what I thought jokingly,
but I don't know if that's where they're going or not. I think there's a number of different ways you can take this, and some of them are darker than others.
Sure.
And I don't think that Holly has shown any fear of shying away from the darkness in this. So,
no.
I mean, I will say that this show so far broadly is very intense. Like an intensity level that I'm surprised is on technically basic cable.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that, you know, that those standards have kind of gotten more fluctuated in this day and age, because although this does debut on FX, it is, you know, FX is primarily a streaming play these days. I think it's fair. It's primarily the main source for like some of the best programming that's on Hulu. You know, to the extent that there is even a subsection of Hulu called FX on Hulu, where there's stuff that FX develops to go straight to Hulu. But this show is airing on FX. So it is airing on non-premium cable.
Oh, interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the Alien franchise. We shouldn't necessarily be surprised that there's some really disturbing imagery in terms of violence and in terms of horror.
In particular, a subgenre that you've mentioned a couple times that I'm always a little bit trepidatious about calling a genre, but if any franchise, you know, leans into the body horror tropes and the fear of giving birth and having foreign bodies invade you, like Alien has always been one of those.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think not only are they... is that element there, but this element of transferring human consciousness into synthetics is a form of body horror too.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not as visceral or gory, but it certainly does fit into those same things about foreign bodies intruding on another life form.
Well,
and while we're on the
and
topic,
placing and placing children into adult bodies at that too, like, you know,
yeah,
there's And that's kind of what I was alluding to with the potential for darkness here is, you know, I mean, Sydney Chandler is an attractive adult woman.
Hey, but we were into Poor Things. So like, who are we to judge?
Yeah. I mean, you know, well, but I mean, Poor Things was also a commentary on that kind of thing. Like it's,
yeah.
I think it's absolutely important ground for science fiction storytelling, which is what Poor Things was too.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't make it less creepy. It's just supposed to be creepy to comment on the creepy things that are going on in our world.
it's interesting that you saw it through that lens, because I looked at it as kind of like arrested development, and how, in particular, like millennials have a reputation for being kind of in arrested development.
Sure.
But, yeah, maybe that's just one aspect, and I don't think you're wrong to notice that.
Well, I mean, I think you can take it in many directions, and that the best metaphors that's true of. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see where Noah Hawley takes this over the run of the series.
While we're on the topic of kind of just setting the world up, and we talked about the synthetics and the hybrids, there was this mission that the Maginot was on, which is that ship that we referred to. They went to different corners of the galaxy, and they picked up these life forms. So not only do we have a xenomorph in this series, but there are also multiple other invasive, disgusting, parasitic creatures that get loose aboard this ship before it ultimately crash lands on Earth. So in addition to having our xenomorphs landing on Earth, we've also got these other creatures that we know nothing about that have landed on Earth.
You know what?
I kind of wanted to know what you thought about that.
I'm really glad they did that, because it introduces things that we haven't seen before, which I think is important. And it plays up, like, the xenomorphs are so familiar now that in some ways it's kind of hard to be scared of them. But when they're
I think that's interesting. But when they're
just one element, I think that they can continue to be scary. And I think that that is, it's kind of like, we talked about this when we talked about the Jurassic franchise a few weeks ago, and about how there's these beats that they keep going back to, but some of them, they do it because it works. And like the beat of the beat of the T-Rex coming in, and at one point, does the T-Rex get away from being scary and become the guy that, you know, the T-Rex inadvertently saves the day kind of thing? I don't think that's where we're going here. I think that this is actually helping to restore menace to the xenomorph.
I think that's a really interesting point, because in Scott's film, so much of the suspense and the unease comes from the fact that we don't really know what this creature is. But at that point, it's become so like zeitgeisty that we could draw it from memory. But by putting in these other creatures that we don't really understand, it brings back that element of like a lack of understanding.
Yeah, it kind of elevates everybody. It elevates everything. And there's some scenes in this where the xenomorph is shot in such a way that it feels scarier than it has maybe since Cameron's film. There's some scenes where you don't.
Is it all practical in this?
I'm not sure, but I'd be interested to find out. But there's like some places where like you don't see the xenomorph in the background until it starts to move.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, like it's there watching. Like it feels more intelligent than it ever has in some
ways.
And
there's just one of them. And if I had one critique about aliens, is that they essentially made them kind of cannon fodder. This one right here reestablishes the xenomorph as a real menace. Like, this thing is a problem.
Well, and again, it's not the only thing that can kill you, because you had like that slug creature that was crawling all over people and then hitting them in their carotid artery. That gave me the willies. And then the eyeball creature that was on the cat.
Uh-huh.
Oh man, that shook me. You know, so
it's so nasty.
And again, this is where, you know, we get into, this is pretty intense stuff for basic cable, if you think about it. We're going to talk about this a little more when we come back. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Thank you.
Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I'm your host, Julio Diaz. Man, there's a lot going on in that song. It's kind of hard to figure out where to come in over that. It's just such a complex song. It's a beautiful song called Killer Crane by TV on the Radio that is used in the new series Alien Earth on FX, which is what we're talking about this week on the show. Jeremy, we've kind of talked a lot about the aesthetic. We've talked about some of the actors. I think we've made plain already that we're pretty hyped on this.
Oh yeah, big fan. I think there was a little apprehension when Disney took over, but Romulus put a lot of that to ease, and we established this as we mentioned as kind of a true follow up to Ridley Scott's contributions to the Alien franchise, because I think that's the stuff that outlasted a lot of the stuff that we got in things like Alien 3 and Resurrection, and even again Prometheus and Covenant. So yeah, I was a big fan of this. I want to kind of say, and this is not so much spoilers as general plot, but that ship, Maginot, was a Yutani vessel, and it goes down in Prodigy Corporation's country. Because as you said, there's like five corporations that own the world.
Not just the world, but other planets, too. Like it's there. Yeah. It's there in dialogue that, you know, Weyland-Yutani controls North and South America. Prodigy is in one of the main settings that where Prodigy's headquarters is New Siam. So that's basically the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, so these five corporations kind of control different portions of the globe, but also control different planets in the solar system as well.
So that ship goes down in Prodigy territory, like you said, in New Siam, and these creatures are about to get loose on it. We meet Yutani of Weyland and Yutani fame. Obviously, Peter Weyland died after Prometheus, so at this point, I think Miss Yutani has taken over. And we suspect she's got some ulterior motives for why she would basically target this city to crash, but they end up, Prodigy sends in their search and rescue team. Also, Boy Cavalier, the owner of the corporation Prodigy, knows that the girl, Wendy, wants to go and rescue her brother, who she's been kind of watching from afar. So he allows them to go in on kind of this covert mission to test out their abilities. And it leads to this awesome, almost like the Raid Redemption or Dread style scene where they go into this big high-rise building and are trying to clear the place out because there's this rogue species on the loose. So
yeah,
that's kind of the crux of where we're at right now.
See, that's where I feel like we shift more from the Ridley Scott to the James Cameron. Like that felt like sending in the Colonial Marines to me. But except in this case, the Colonial Marines are inexperienced and children, basically.
Yeah.
But superpowered children. Because
episode 2 has one of my favorite scenes in it. It's because it's so bizarre, and there's this group of like wealthy elites that are all dressed like 18th century French characters, almost like the Marie Antoinette, you know.
Aristocratic, and they don't want to listen to anything, and you know, well, I'm in the same club as Boy Cavalier, and he'd call me personally if there was a problem.
Yeah. And they're like, dude, you really need to get out of here.
Yeah, Boy Cavalier did not care about that guy.
Not even the slide. He probably don't care about anybody.
Well, he makes it clear.
When the xenomorph gets you in there, it is so disturbing.
Yeah, well, to say that Boy Cavalier probably doesn't care, I think that's actually spelled out. There's a great scene where Boy Cavalier talks about what his motivation for creating these synthetics is, these hybrids, that he hopes that he can develop someone that he will consider to be a being that he will consider to be smarter than himself because he thinks he's the smartest person in the world.
And he probably is in some specific ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, talk about Cavalier really fitting his archetype to a D.
And he just wants to be able to have a decent conversation with somebody. He says this to one of his employees, who's this genius scientist. Like, and to him, she's, you know, pawn scum. So did he care about these people and these aristocrats in his apartment building? No, please. That was the Marie Antoinette thing was a very apt comparison because that was very much a let them eat cake moment.
And there's this scene where Joe is going through after kind of the carnage happens and everybody's almost frozen in time with that costumes on and just covered in crimson. It's like some really disturbing horror imagery in it, but I do feel like, and I know this isn't unusual to any series, but CJ, Joe, Hermit, all the same character, he's got some pretty heavy plot armor, don't he?
Yeah, well, if we haven't made this clear, Joe Hermit is a medic. He's a human medic that works for the Prodigy Corporation. He's sent in on the search and rescue mission, but he is also Wendy's brother, who has believed her to be dead. Because this deal that they made to save these kids by making them hybrids, they can't ever see their families again, and their families believe them to be dead. Other than the parent that made this deal that knows that this is what's happening to them, they to the world, these children are dead. So he's believed that his sister died,
he has to grapple with the reality that not only is she still alive, but now she's in this completely different form, and him kind of quizzing her is a cool scene.
Well, and she's been told to keep it secret, and she's doing her best to keep it secret while still, being completely obvious, because she's 12.
Uh-huh.
To those of us who see what's going on, like, I could see where the brother might think it's just a coincidence, but, like, she's making like really obvious references to things that they were happened when they were kids. She calls his dad, she had told one of the other people. And of course this kid is younger than her. He's like 10 and he can't keep the secret. It's like, that's your sister,
like,
dude.
Don't tell anybody. And you're like, oh, this is bad.
Yeah. Yeah. He's immediately telling everybody because he's 10 and he has no self-control whatsoever.
Yeah.
So at this point where we leave off at the end of episode 2, they know that this is the brother and sister. We have this great moment where he's like quizzing her on things and, he finally realizes, yes, this really is her. And it's this intense moment that maybe it's not the time to be having that moment when you're in the middle of, being swarmed by things that want to eat you.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple different things that want to eat you or just tear you up or maybe drop their eggs in your body and have, things burst out of your chest or,
Must be what he's trying to do with Joe. When I say that must be what the xenomorph is trying to do with him, because instead of just eviscerating him, he like kidnaps him.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting too, because they don't want it's clear they don't want the synthetics. Like, the synthetics can walk by unharmed.
Yeah.
The hybrids even. I'm interested about there's a cyborg character in this too, who works for the Weyland-Yutani Corporation and who is very much just driven to do what they want.
Very
interesting character. Yeah. I'm interested to see, it doesn't seem like the aliens attacking them either,
which is weird,
but it may just be because he's gotten the drop on him. So I'm not sure whether that character is in danger from the xenomorphs or not.
Yeah, because I've heard like they respond to fear, but the xenomorph clearly kills Ash, who is more likely to be unafraid than Cyborg is, because cyborgs are people. But like, what is the extent of his modifications?
Yeah, yeah. This is all very interesting. Like I said, there's a lot more commentary going on here beyond just the what's on the surface. I really like the first two episodes of this series. I'm really interested to see where this goes, but this is the best this franchise has been since James Cameron. I already very confidently say that after just two episodes. So we'll definitely be looking in on this again, but we got to go for this week. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.